here yesterday. How many were not here yesterday? Oh, my. Are you new? Did you come in today? Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, what I'm... Oh, wait a minute. Ready, Betty. I am Edna Hong, and I am reading Clues to the Kingdom. This is the second session of reading Clues to the Kingdom. This is a book that I wrote, began writing here at Holden Village. It's the first one I wrote after Howard and I reared a family of eight, and they were pretty well reared. They never are completely. So I wrote this book about, and I wrote it to answer a question that had been bugging me for about 2 years, maybe all my life. What did Christ mean when he said, except you become like a child, you cannot enter the kingdom? So my query was, what do we lose? And what do we as parents rearing children cause them to lose that Christ doesn't want us to lose and that we must regain, he says, we wish to enter the kingdom. So I use one grandchild, my first grandchild, as sort of a composite. I fill her with all the experiences that I had had with the children, all the children. And so she furnishes the clues. I am the grandma. She furnishes the clues. What did Jesus mean? Clue by clue. So, well, you missed all the clues yesterday. You'll just have to clue in right here. And this one, this chapter is called Murdering the Kingdom English. I don't know if you get the play on words, murdering the king's English, murdering the kingdom English. Lord, it wasn't until I was through being angry that I realized you had slipped in another clue. While Krista napped this afternoon, I watched a TV program, one I had watched many times before, but it never affected me the way it did today. Now this TV program, it's no longer on, but it went on for many years, and it was children and one certain person who became sort of famous because of that. Well, I became angry when I saw that because they put kids in a box, in a bright lighted box in a darkened room. They put words in their mouths, cheap, worn out words, slightly soiled. Hearing their own words in the mouths of innocents, they laugh loudly, like monsters. That's the way I felt about it. Lord, your Father created man a subject. And we have let ourselves become object and insist on making our fellow men into objects. Child is supremely a subject, and we make even child an object. Lord, you are a teacher. You know the kingdom grammar. How can you stand to hear us murder the kingdom English in this way? A teaspoon of man's liquid lust spills and spawns a child. Or man intends child, makes child the object of his selfish drives, his selfish ambitions and greeds, the fruit of his survival urges, deductible dependent on his tax forms, consumer for his products, citizen for his states, cannon fodder for the world's armies. Actually, at one time when I was very, very pregnant, and I was walking through a park, and workmen were repairing the steps of the park, and I had to walk by them. I'd no sooner got by them when one man said to another, more cannon fodder. Oh. So that's how that got in there. Let's see. One more political vote, one more inductee for our military, one more convert for our crusades, one more card in the church files, one more shopper, buyer, client, patient, one more charger plate, one more credit card. Lord, Lord, why do you tolerate such misuse of divine grammar? Why don't you break the ruler over our heads? Why don't you raise your voice in anger? Listen, you numbskulls, you seniors and elders. Ah, but it is not your way, Lord. It is not the way of one who treats another for what he is, subject. Lord, these nights while Kristen sleeps, I'm reading everything you said. I hang upon your words like a shipwrecked sailor who has not heard human speech for endless years. Tonight you said sorrowfully, Matthew conveyed your message. You did not enter yourselves, and you hindered those who were entering. Ah, there it is. There is the utterly, utterly degenerate, ungrammatical misuse of kingdom grammar, for which not even being stood in a corner is sufficient punishment, not even being stood outside the kingdom. 'Twere better that a millstone is hung about his neck and that he be sunk in the depths of the sea. Why did you think of a millstone, Lord? Because it's apropos, a heavy object for us who make objects of created subjects. The next chapter is called The Ancient Grudge. I took her to the arboretum today. I thought I'd introduce her to the flora and the fauna. She skipped ahead of me along the path, greeted a blue jay with delighted laughter. Without knowing its name, either the familiar or the formal, she greeted it as if it were an old acquaintance. She touched a cluster of harebells as tenderly and tranquilly as she sometimes strokes my face, hugged the adolescent birch as if it were her favorite babysitter. I introduce her to your father's creation? Lord, I get your clue. Child is at home in creation. Pink sand, tinted seashells, dappled pebbles, sparkling rain beads, muzzling kittens, nudging puppies, furry caterpillars know and are known by child. And all this juice and all this joy, all this grace and favor which you created in child to celebrate the radiant mystery of creation, all this we lose in fresh fall, inheriting the ancient grudge. Man desires to possess and monopolize creation, and it will not. Man seeks to seize and dominate creation, and it becomes his enemy. Man demands sum and substance of creation, and it envelops him like an ulcerated stomach. Child runs toward your creation with open arms, and we hurl ourselves at your creation as if we were greedy, suckling pigs, and the world a brooding sow. Therefore, Lord, to set the record straight, I place in the files, the grimly glutting files where I'm recording man's alien touch, two sad and silly songs. Song one. Child likes the cow all red and white. We like the milk check with all our might. Child likes little piglets so pink and so sweet. We like pork chops and pickled pig's feet. Great poetry. Child likes the hens, some brown, some white. The money the eggs bring is our delight. Child likes the black Angus who thinks he's boss. We like his steaks with Worcester sauce. Child likes the ducks with their quack, quack, quack. We like them best on the barbecue rack. And then song number two is titled Useless Things. Useless. Ripe fruit that falls untasted, wasted. Maids that can't be lured to bed, unwed. I wrote that 20 years ago. Sincerity, integrity, if they have no utility for our economy. Crippled horses, old, decrepit people, the dead, once their wills are read. The next chapter is called The Jammed Communication System. Lord, today I think I saw the antenna you stationed in Kristen's North Pole, where her wheat straw hair meets in a funny little swirl. It's a most acutely sensitive instrument. When glad surprises surge in from all sides, it sways madly. It trembles to weather. It trembles to fields. It trembles to sea sand. It trembles to most anything. And when she simply stands and stares at nothing in particular, her antenna is no doubt sending her a very delicate communication. Lord, I wonder if we do not begin jamming your communication system when we begin teaching child to pray. Thank you for the food we eat. Thank you, God, for bread and meat. As if bread, meat, and potatoes were the only thankworthy gifts. I wonder if the antenna would go dead if we taught child to celebrate your whole wonderful system of communication. For example, Lord, touch. Thank you for cobwebs that lightly touch my face and gently remind me of soundless things like spiders and butterflies. Have you ever gone out, first one on a path in the woods in the morning, and there's cobwebs across, and you're constantly breaking cobwebs, and you have to ask the spiders forgiveness? Crickets and bees don't need to spin reminders. Thank you for the cool squishiness of mud, the roundness and hardness of pebbles, the steep upness and downness of hills, the rippled firmness of wave-washed sand, the cool surprise of raindrops, the kiss of sun on bare skin, the warm red feel of garden-ripe strawberries, the foam feel, my pony's velvet nose, my dog's tongue, which tells my hand and face he loves me, and the gift of tender touch you gave to me to say it back to him. As a matter of fact, Lord, I don't think you threw thunderbolts at Adam on his second day out of dust when you said, "Good morning, Adam, how do you feel?" And Adam answered, "Great, Lord, I feel great. And thank you for the feel of Eve. Thank you, Lord, for shaping Eve different from me." Or was Adam a poet? Did he write a song of Adam in praise of Eve, only the publishers rejected it and took Solomon's instead? And then I quote the Song of Solomon. "Behold, you are beautiful, my love, behold, you are beautiful. Your eyes are doves behind your veil. Your hair is like a flock of goats moving down the slopes of Gilead. Your teeth are like a flock of shorn ewes that have come up from this washing. Your lips are like a scarlet thread, and your mouth is lovely. Your cheeks are like halves of a pomegranate behind your veil. Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle that feed among the lilies." Ah, Lord, I have come to see that when we see and are seen, hear and are heard, touch and are touched, smell and are smelled, taste and are tasted, we are more present in spirit, and spirit is more present in us. The senses you created in us are on the side of spirit. Lord, creation callousness is not separate from kingdom callousness. Blunting, dulling, and deadening the senses of child, killing the sentient child, is not only a sin against nature, it's a sin against the kingdom. Lord, Where does guilt stop? Is there no boundary to sin? And if I were to write this now, I would put in TV as the greatest killer of sentient self. And the next chapter is called A Moldy Crust of Bread. Today, Lord, a giant jet crashed in the Near East. There were no survivors. Our Air Force bombed a village in the Far East, and two African countries broke off relations. A child in New York was raped and murdered, and an old woman in Seattle was bludgeoned to death and robbed of $3.67. And yet, Lord, Kristen is lying up in her bed singing. Is this a clue to the kingdom or not? Yes, yes, I know. Life tastes good to child. The knobby, parched, and puckered apple of life tastes good. I know, too, that child skips lightly up the ramp of time and does not look down, does not see the dizzy chasm, the appalling abyss, the nightmare pit. The fates hurl their atom bombs, and child tosses them back. They fall lightly like balloons on a breathless day. The earth shatters, and child leaps in ecstasy. The universe rocks, child turns handsprings. Each night sleep comes on tiptoe to child, sweeps up the loose ash of the day, and scours the grudge smudge away. Each morning child cups his hands and receives life thumb rim full and lets fear slip through her little fingers. And we, Lord, we wake from troubled sleep, loath to accept the dubious gift of a new day. And while we lie abed, reluctant to get up, our ancient fears and hostilities drip their distilled poison into the cup which sleep has emptied. Life has a daily sameness taste, like a damp and moldy crust of bread left over and forgotten. Lord, if this is a clue, I'll challenge it. I'll grant you that compared to buoyant, bouncy child, we live a ghastly, ghosted life. I'll grant you the child relishes the whole wheat bread of daily life, and that we ask our bread to be buttered with fresh churned butter spread with homogenized honey and curse it when expectation becomes stale disappointment. But child spontaneity, Lord, is born of ignorance and innocence. Heaven lies about us in our infancy, and the landscape of childhood is fair indeed for the child lucky enough to be loved. But then comes hell. The scales of innocence flake off, and child begins to see the human scape. And then the illustrator did a marvelous thing. She has just two dark pages. On one page, like a little child, what do you mean? Once we have tasted sin, subhuman stew, how can life taste good again? You said it yourself. Well, this reminds me of something I read after I wrote this. I think I would have tried to include it if I had read it before. And I thought about it for an ancient church father called the fall God's creation, the first painting, or he called it a painting. Well, then I decided if God's creation is a painting, then the fall is the first graffiti, so or the first vandalism. Well, where they vandalize paintings. You said it yourself. I am the bread of life. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. How does one get this bread, Lord? How does one get you? Now, please don't give me all the stilted answers to all the questions I never asked and never cared to know and had to memorize word for word. Ah, was that it, Lord? I never asked. And I never cared to know. The next one is called cross-examination. Speaking of questions, Lord, somebody remarked today that a person gives his true self away in the questions he asks. Splendid. I shall herewith record in my dossier and place in my fat files on the case of the lost kingdom the questions I have heard this week. The questions women asked. Where have you been? Who was there? What did you eat? What did they wear? What did they talk about? He's marrying her? What does he see in her? Don't you think it's a sin? The questions men asked. Why should I stick my neck out? What's in it for me? How much did it cost? What make did he buy? Where can I get it for less? Who's ahead? What's the score? What's Anaconda today? The questions Christians asked. Where does your lap go when you stand up, Grandma? Why doesn't day stay? Where do the stars stay all day? What do angleworms eat for breakfast? Why don't big people turn somersaults? Why don't they even try? Do fish talk to each other? What's the chipmunk saying? Lord, need more be said? Child's questions smell of life, man's of death. When does the moon dim and the machine begin to shine? When does the mockingbird grow still and the cash register begin to sing? When does the ocean stagnate and the stock market become majestic? When does creation play out and things become exuberant? Oh Lord, reply, reply. I should have read that, and things become exuberant. But you don't reply. I pile up evidence against humankind, against the whole stinking human race, and you silently hand it back to me. Silently. But your very silence cross-examines. Why do you have to make everything so squirmy, personal? And then the next one is the clock stopped at. Kristen has been here 2 weeks now, and in all that time, she's never asked, Grandma, what time is it? Lord, why is it child never asks, what time is it? Until we adults teach him the question. And then she never ceases to ask the time. For child, the ticking of a watch is a gay and marching rhythm. A disembodied sound, unbuttoned from the past and the future, not yet attached to urgent schedules. Child's now is fluid. It flows on and on, full of always, always now. For child, time is unforgettable time in which he or she forgets time. Is this why child just sort of flows into your kingdom? Right through the walls of that kingdom? While we who have lost the kingdom beat, bang, and batter at the gate. Let us in before it's too late. Time is running out. Is this why we troubled transients in time cry for yesterday, wait for tomorrow, and despise today, the disease that is our present? The pendulums swing, the hour hands crawl, the minute hands walk, the second hands run, and what do the clocks say to us adults? We number the days are numbered, time is running out. The past is gone, the present is going, the future is not yet. Now is vacant, volatile, a desperate interim. We punctuate the emptiness, we regulate the void. That's what the clocks say to us veterans of childhood. Lord, I use this at LBI, so my LBI friends are here. To hear it again. Lord, what a terrible conception of time and eternity we adults have. For us, eternity is tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow, some other then, some other there, lasting forever, arriving never. How infinitely remote, how devastatingly lonely, I do not want to sit and wait and wait and wait and wait for such a future. I get your clue, Lord. Child's first timeless time is a moving picture of eternity. Your eternity broke and breaks into time. You, the I am, who was, is, and ever shall be, offer yourself to me here, where I am, now, when I am what I am. And the next one is, tell me the exact time when it happened. We had a visitor today, a female relative, an unctuous dame. Lord, I'm a woman, but I can't bear women who, when they speak to children, butter their voices, pitch them sweet, chirp and twitter, tweet, tweet, tweet. Honey, she bleated, and her buttered popcorn words left oil smears on the freshly rain-washed air. What are you going to be when you grow up? I think, said Kristen gravely, with a taking everything into consideration look, I think I'll be me. I almost said, until I understood that she was just another clue, can you tell me the precise time when child comes to be? At 5 a.m. with the sunrise of sex? At 7 a.m., when she flips the tassel of her board. At 10 a.m., when he goes to bed with bride. Come, tell me, please, when is the moment to be? How utterly absurd to say that child is preparing for life. The child will become somebody someday. Perhaps the minute he gets his first paycheck. Being is not a finished product, wrapped, dated, and delivered up at a proper time under specific conditions. Being is a nucleus unfolding, a never happened before God-given self growing up to the light, finding its true self. Child is being on the way now, concretely full of personal being now. Lord, it looks as if losing the kingdom has something to do with our thinking of child as a rib-bound, bone-braced, skin-snug, pint-proportioned container, deficient in time, devoid of being, into which we, the venerable ones, pour content. It has something to do with our thinking of ourselves as gargantuan gallon urns, replete with time, exuberant with being, pouring the superfluity of our too muchness into child's hollow container. Thanks, Lord. There's consolation in this clue, as well as knuckle rapping and conceit spanking. You've waited long for me, Lord, but I don't have to wait to enter the kingdom until my virtues weigh 775 pounds. My nobility is 10 feet tall, and my self-confidence is bright orange. Well, the next chapter is called, this is What is Truth. This is all very Kierkegaardian. Where have you been? The female visitor is still there. The female visitor to Kristen, helicoptering home from secret worlds and ampler orbits. Said Kristen, in the big green forest, and a cub bear ate my popsicle. Lord, I had to do it. I spiked her, that's the female visitor, I spiked her lecture on truth with a pilot thrust. What is truth? Of course, we got nowhere. She hit me over the head with her tidy tenets, and when I grabbed her confounded concepts and proceeded to undress them, take off their wrappings and their trappings, she got so very embarrassed at their nakedness that she fled. Naked truth, peeled and pared, husked and hulled. Lord, isn't that the way that truth dwells in child and child dwells in truth? Truth is what is interior to child, naked, integral, and incarnate. Truth is what is exterior to child, manifest, transparent, luminous, and unmistakable. Child carries her interior truth in front of her like a bright red flag. Child wears his interior meaning on his face, and we read its gospel truth word for word. Child is the truth that he knows, and this is truth, becoming and being the truth one knows. Is this a clue to kingdom loss? That we have long since ceased in all humility to become and to be the truths we talk and write about? Lord, I just had a vagabond vision. I saw a procession of scientists, analysts, theologues, pedagogues, Hebraists, Sanskritists, philosophers, lexicographers in solemn procession, marching to the kingdom. Stopped at the gate. Not even the weight of the tons and tons of volumes and tomes they had written won their way in. And a barefoot boy in jeans darted between their legs and trotted right into your kingdom and didn't even have to hold out his hands to show that they were clean. Ah, but this was only just another... irreverent vision. And my fumbling for truth brings only partial truth. Who is able to be the truth he knows? Not even child can do that, can be that. Forgive me for romanticizing, idealizing, sentimentalizing child. Lord God Almighty, all-knowing, all-wise, omniscient, infinite, and eternal one, I don't want crumbs and scraps of truth. I want the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. God, when we humans have dealings with each other, when we want to affirm something is true, we give our word for it. That's all I ask, God, your word. Oh, Christ, how blind can I be? You were. You are that word. Oh, word of God, mystery revealed, truth made manifest, word made flesh. And we crucified you. The next one is Escape Artist. That was a great breakthrough last night, but somehow clues are still breaking into my thick skull. An unmistakable one today. Kristen walked through a wall, a solid, strong, and stubborn. So solid, strong, and stubborn that Houdini would have blanched and bolted, but not Kristen. She walked right through that pitiless barrier as if it were child's play, and not a hair of her head was rumpled. Went through it as if she didn't see it, but it's there. And no one knows better than you, Lord, that it's there. Higgledy piggledy potpourri, a la potida, gala mafi. Without once having heard of caste, class, or race, interracial harmony and desegregation, interracial unity and integration, or for that matter, the American dilemma, prejudice and discrimination, segregation and recrimination, the Ku Klux Klan, little white Kristen tripped to town, skipping with Nat, who was chocolate brown. White and black, yellow and brown dance together in the children's town. And your higgledy piggledy kingdom, Lord, belongs to such as these, who walk through all the color, caste, and class barriers and quietly split all the iron curtains we adults raise. Your higgledy piggledy kingdom, Lord, belongs to such as these, who see every living thing just as it is, just as Adam saw the world, with no prejudices, no anxieties, no fears, no formally formed associations. Your higgledy-piggledy kingdom, Lord, belongs to such as these who know the truth, and the truth possessed makes them or keeps them free.
Liberty? Freedom? Lord, the clue hit a snag. I have a feeling that the liberty of your father's children is more than skin deep and boundary wide. I suspect that the best way to escape the man pound, where humans who have lost their freedom are impounded, is to dig deep down into the narrow place which is our prison. Set me to digging, O heavenly hound, tenaciously and joyfully, hot on the heels of freedom, and scattering catchwords and slogans as a dog scatters dirt in a hedgehog hole. Lord, I'm warning you, I'm going to grab hold of this freedom mystery and hang on as tenaciously as a bulldog, wrestle with it as stubbornly as Jacob with his angel. Last night I read the next chapter, which is on the freedom of the human will and what we have done to it. We have made ourselves a conditioned society where we blame everything. And God made us free beings, the most wonderful gift. And I ended that. I read that last night because I wanted Fritz Norsted to hear it, because he'd given a lecture that was very much like it. I'm just going to read the last part of that. Oh, incomprehensible mystery, that you, the omnipotent, made me to be free. Oh, inconceivable marvel, that you, the all-powerful, grant so much liberty to me that you ask me, will you have me or not? And you wait for my answer. Well, I can't read that. Again, there isn't time. Now, this next one is the malignant climate. Come, Kristen, I said this morning. Let's go down by the creek and see if the asters are blooming. Maybe the elderberries are ripe and the adolescent frogs are jumping. Please come. Kristen, now remember this is right after the chapter on freedom, free by the grace of God and carrying her gift lightly within her interior self, put her hand into mine. We two absolutes, separate and free, joined our hands, locked our fingers, and walked together, linked and inseparable. Lord, isn't that exactly what you want? Free beings related in freedom. Is there any sight more beautiful to you in heaven and on earth than free beings choosing one another, associating with one another, working with one another, playing with one another in freedom? Isn't that the secret of all truly creative human relationships? Isn't this the secret of the tragedy of no relationship? Cribbed in laxity, full of hostility, flaunting authority, the 20th century person thinks to be free means I against all for me, I for no one, no one for me. And in the very detachment he or she demands, thinking this is freedom, he or she builds the walls of prison, isolates himself or herself in the terrifying loneliness of solitary confinement. Lord, in your higgledy-piggledy kingdom, freedom equals attachment, and capacity for freedom equals capacity for attachment. In your crazy kingdom arithmetic, it takes two to make one. Two free and loving solitudes to make one strong, healthy, indissoluble relationship. One plus one equals one. To grow like a tree upward ascending, child needs a climate advancing its being. Lord, I'm beginning to see the dilemma. I'm beginning to see the dimensions of the crime. Child, neither philosopher nor theologian grasps spontaneously at your gift of freedom. Child, creature of space and time, but intended for the kingdom,
craves relation to these three, your Holy Trinity, your creature, man, your creation. All child wants is what child needs, the favorable climate where he or she can learn to trust and love these three, your Holy Trinity, your creature, man, your creation. Child remains free to the precise extent he or she is able to love these three, your Holy Trinity, your creature, man, your creation. If God, if child, whom you give to us in trust, receives of us a climate hostile to you, hostile to humankind, hostile to nature, how can child come into the kingdom? The absence of thee, O lethal legacy, crime that ought Herod's Herod. I see what you mean, Lord, about visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children to the third and fourth generation of those that hate me. Next one is called The Night Was Dyed Its Deepest Black. Starlight, star bright, first star I see tonight. I wish I might, get the wish I wish tonight. We lay on the knoll of the apple orchard, riding the crest of the spinning earth, watching the stars come out and wishing on every star. Finally, when it looked as if someone had sifted granulated stars all over the ceiling of the world, Kristen cried, Grandma, Grandma, a sky full of wishes. Lord, how many of your children went to sleep tonight under a sky full of hope? How many are sleeping this night the deep and dreamless sleep of those who hope? How many will rise refreshed tomorrow, renewed by the sleep of hope? How many, O Lord, toss and turn this night under a darkened sky, waiting without hope for morning? How many lie staring in the dark while the blind moles of despair tunnel deeper? How many will rise tomorrow more exhausted in body, mind, and spirit than when they went to bed? Lord, I'm beginning to see that hope is the oxygen of the kingdom, and that the mood of despair shuts out the air of heaven. Hope lives in child, a fragile flower, subject to frost and the desert winds, basically and fundamentally and all unaware, the infant child wishes and hopes and wills spontaneously and immediately what you, Lord, will infinitely. Affirmation and acceptance, response and love. If child's world neither affirms nor accepts, responds to nor loves, the stars go out for child, one by one, all over the sky. And that's where the real trouble starts, back there with the death of hope in the heart of a little child. Apathy and indifference, absence of feeling, absence of concern, non-involvement, negativity and hostility, pessimism and defeatism, futility, paralysis of will, the all-pervading despair, all begin with the death of hope in the heart of a little child. Lord, has there ever been an age like this when the intellectual elite, the arty aesthete, and the insolent beat find life at the core a nauseous bore, a slatternly whore, and fall in love with despair? I went to your word to see, read the Old Testament preacher of pessimism, read the plaintive poet of lamentations, but there I found only the right kind of despair, the despair which says, I find no hope in me, therefore I hope in thee for me. Lord, I see, the kingdom hope is not a silly grinning hope, a happy ending optimism, a pill-produced brighter mood, and everything will turn out in the end, hope. a daydreaming, self-glorifying hope. The kingdom hope is greater than child's rosy-cheeked hope, which is a blithe sense of the possible, a gay faith in being able, the spontaneity and imagination to support both, and the resilience to bounce back when it's dashed down. The kingdom hope is the stripped of all earthly hope, the hope which says, I find no hope in me, therefore I hope in thee for me. Slow strangulation. A very subdued Christmas tonight. Tonight at bedtime it came out. I don't like your house so much anymore, Grandma. And so I called my son, told him love had not run out, but home longing had filtered in. Frankly, I'm puzzled, Lord. Is this a clue to kingdom loss? Child loves spontaneously, and spontaneous love is, well, if not fickle, it's frangible. And the trouble and the tragedy of what passes for love these days is that it remains childish love, spontaneous love, subject to change, and therefore inconstant. Ring the bell madly, I've fallen in love. Toll the bell sadly, I've fallen out again. Lord, when you said that we cannot enter the kingdom unless we become like children, did you mean that we are to love like children? Kristen tonight expressed her loneliness and love for the two you in your first and foremost love gave to her to love, love into her, gave to her to love, love into her. Into her what, Lord? Into her ableness to love. Oh, Lord, that's it, that's it. The love ableness of the child spirit is what you want us to recover. Love ableness resides in child as a love need of the spirit, a deeper love need than the love need of the body. Love need in child is a perfect vacuum, offering no hindrance whatsoever to love. It inhales love as naturally and freely as voided lungs inhale oxygen, and needs love just as much. And if the nucleus of love, the love disposition of child, cannot ascend to the light, it descends to the dark. It cannot love, it must hate. Sinned against and sinning, love ableness in child becomes an impermeability, a crippled capacity, a cancered lung, silted with sin and exhaling hate and hostility. What resided in child as simple childish openness now is closed upness and inability to relate and love. You are taking away my clue giver, Lord. You must think the mystery is practically solved. Are you going to leave unanswered my last question? Can the sinning love each other? Spirit of love, did you tenderly hold old John's hand and literally escort it across the scroll, tracing the utterly simple words of that utterly extraordinary message? We love because you first loved us. Ah, I shall memorize that first letter of John's word, word for wonderful word. Crucified love, you who made visible what love is, your love is perfected in us. This is the miracle. This is the task. The cancer of hate can be eradicated, and the love ableness of child restored. The love vacuum can be filled with love. We can love again like children who are loved first, like children whose initial original love ableness is nurtured and not disabled. And then Kristen goes home, and then I say, we poor beings, no, I see, I know and have seen the ugly crevices and craters on the lovely face of life. But you, O divine juggler, you have lifted me to the other side of sin, I skipped some here, to the kingdom of the second spontaneity. We poor beings are always searching for the button of happiness. Some few sift the gray matter, some many reconnoiter in the sex organs, others hunt among the taste buds, Others probe with needle and alcohol, but your kingdom man, Paul, put the finger on the button right away. Law came in to increase the trespass, but where sin increased, grace abounded all the more. You took me far out, deep down and under my quiet and cultivated and always dignified rebellion. You showed me my nothingness, but not to make me despair, only to show me the greatness of your grace. Lord, I bless your rod. Your clues piled sin upon sin, trespass upon trespass, until I wondered if I could ever laugh again. But then you laughed into my being with your grace, jubilantly, from the healed, reconciled, and redeemed depths of my being. Joy wells up again, spontaneously, and like a child. Now I'll skip a little bit again and read you the very end. Lord, I don't know what happened yesterday. In quieter, calmer retrospect, it seems that I just shut my eyes and whispered, ready or not, here I come, and I jumped. Today I'm not sure whether I landed in the kingdom or the kingdom landed in me. Is this what they call the leap of faith? Is this what you call being born again? Is this being born into the mystery you have locked within child? Sleeping and waking, I now know grace, your free gift to my free being. Sleeping and waking, I now know how to accept the gift like a child. Sleeping and waking, I know what I have accepted like a child. The gift of life in the kingdom, the gift of the true self, the whole of me, the good and bad, calmly possessed, the gift of the forgiven self, the bad forgiven, the gift of love vitality, the good energized because you loved me first, the gift of now. George MacDonald calls this the holy carelessness of the eternal now. That's what I talked about at LBI. The gift of grace, which child grasps spontaneously and man appropriates paradoxically. I think I can end there. There's one more page, but it doesn't say much more. So we are God's children now. This then is the mystery. This is the miracle. This is the kingdom come. This is eternal life in the eternal now of Jesus Christ. Thank you for listening.